Hello and welcome to the Reaction podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction, and Maggie Pagano, Executive Editor. We're returning after a brief hiatus, but I hope you haven't missed us. Today we're going to talk about the state of the economy going into the autumn period, the new Whitehall appointment, Simon Case as Cabinet Secretary, and then talk a little bit about Biden and Trump and the contours of the contest. So Maggie, can I bring you in? What are your views on the state of the economy? When is the quote unquote crash going to hit?
Well, I think I'm still a little bit optimistic that we are in the process of this V-shaped recovery. There were two really good bits of news today. One is that mortgage approvals are back to pre-pandemic levels, and net credit borrowing is also back at earlier pre-pandemic levels. We've also seen over the last month that July retail sales were back with a big bump. Now, that's on the good news front, and we've seen that Rishi Sunak's Eat Out to Help Out campaign was fantastically successful. Probably too successful in many respects, and a lot of people now are already dropping back. So the converse of that is that there are no signs of people going back, certainly not en masse anyway, to their offices. And I saw some numbers earlier on today about what the impact on the West End would be if it continues as it is. And they're talking about a $10 billion loss in revenues and maybe 50,000 retail jobs being lost. Now, that obviously is catastrophic. And usually things don't turn out quite as bad as predicted. But I think that the getting back to school and getting back to the office is clearly going to be the critical factor over the next few months.
Ian, what are your thoughts?
The thing that concerns me is the report, which has been quite a bit written about this in the last few days, about potential tax rises. And the suggestion is, and I mean, double bluff within double bluff, no one knows quite where this is coming from, whether it's briefed by the Treasury or by the Treasury's enemies, that the Treasury is already thinking about which taxes to raise and when, and wants to go sooner rather than later. I think that would be a terrible mistake. I'm not actually convinced that everyone in the Treasury, in senior parts of Treasury, wants to do that anyway, but it would be the last thing that the economy needs this year are tax rises, particularly tax rises on the parts of the economy that we're going to need to power our way out of the crisis. There's talk of capital gains tax increases. I think that would be a terrible mistake. You want money to be put to work, and you want entrepreneurs to get investing and companies to be started, and you need the economy needs a real kick. The other reason not to do it, I think, and to hold off, is that we simply don't know. As Maggie said, it looks, for the moment, it looks like a V-shaped recovery. And one of the main advantages of that is that the impact on the public finances turns out to be not quite as bad as was initially feared. So the government's need to borrow is not quite as severe. It's obviously going to blow the deficit through the through the ceiling, but it is not potentially quite as bad as it might have been. Therefore, you don't know what you're contending with in terms of extra borrowing for the pandemic year. And there's a big difference between 220 billion of a deficit and 310 billion. So let's wait, I would suggest, and see how things pan out in the next few months. And if it is V-shaped, as Maggie says, of course there's going to be a point at which this has to be paid for, and tax rises will presumably be part of it, but not now and not yet. Do you think that's fair enough, Maggie?
Absolutely. And I think it wouldn't just be a mistake, actually. It would be a catastrophic error. I mean, you would completely strangle any recovery. And even worse, what I think you'd have, and I've heard people already since Sunday talking about, well, you know, we'll just move overseas, we'll go to Zug, if that's what they're going to do to our businesses. It will strangle, households, but also small companies. And I think they're talking about or the suggestion was putting corporation tax up to 24%. Well, I mean, you know, it's just insane. It's backwards. And I think there's a lovely irony here. What Rishi Sunak's eating out campaign project showed is that if you cut the price, you increase demand. Now, you could say that's a lovely example that he should look at for taxes. If he could cut taxes, particularly as we've talked before, Ian, entrepreneurs' relief, even capital gains, maybe on investments in the junior stock market on AIM, up, you know, companies up to 200 million, actually cut it, so make it more attractive to people, which is just what he did with the eat out thing. So he should look to his own examples to give him guidance for what he needs to do next.
What are your thoughts on the kind of shape of the economy? Because I mean, there's now a big debate on the return to the office. And I know the FT every weekend seems to do another feature on the future of the office, to the extent that it's kind of, you know, get over it. But it's, you know, it appears to me from where I live, which is in Southeast London, in Brockley, where as a village, it seems to be thriving. The cafes are full, little shops open, people coming and going. And then the moment you get on a train into the centre of London, it, you know, I was in Fleet Street yesterday. There are boarded up shops on Fleet Street. It's incredible to me. What do you think about the shape of the economy? Is it going to go back to normal, or are we going to be stuck with sort of empty city centres?
Personally, I think that it is changing and will change dramatically, not irretrievably, but this is the start of a shift that was already happening. And what the pandemic has shown, and it's why you've seen so many big and surprising employers like Schroeder's, some of the big law firms, saying that actually people could perhaps work from home indefinitely, is that productivity doesn't go down. Now, of course, these are companies who hope to save on costs. But they, what they have all acknowledged is that people do need to be together, and that you'll probably have smaller offices where people maybe meet twice a week, once a month. I think we're going to see a much more fluid, agile working style. And it might well be, ironically, again, that, you know, the sort of levelling up to the local towns and regions will be the consequence of this pandemic. But I think what won't happen is the West End will not be dead forever. You know, there will be life, but it will be very different. And a lot of property will inevitably be converted into residential, which again has to be a good thing. I mean, it should help immediately with, you know, helping the housing crisis. So I think it will change. People need to meet together. They will always meet up. But it might not be in the same way that it has been over the last 20 years. No, Ian, what do you think? You're much more of an office, get back to the office person than me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you make it sound though, Maggie, as though I'm determined to drive people back to the office, which would be a bit hypocritical. Which for years I haven't worked full time in one newspaper office for about, I think, a decade. Like you, Maggie, worked for various people involved in running Reaction. I've written books, and most of that's done from home, and so I've done the mix and match thing. So I'm not it's not because I particularly have a love of the office. I just think that we're social animals, and I think a lot of the best stuff that happens in terms of creativity happens when people gather together, and it happens on the edge of meetings, or people passing each other in the corridor, or agreeing to have a cup of tea or a drink, or a team that is working very hard and working late, which then decides to repair for a gin and tonic or a pint at 8 o'clock. And you get that kind of bonding, which then produces ideas. So I think that's in danger of being lost. I also think there's something very selfish being perpetuated by 40 something and 50 something established people in the main professions, that they've had that fun. And well, it's not all fun. Some of it's watching people make terrible mistakes and learning that that's not how to run an organization. But they've had that formative experience in their 20s and 30s. During COVID-19, they've been, in many of them, in nice houses with nice gardens, saying, isn't this grand, this working from home business, which is not the same as renting a room in a flat with three other people and having to work sitting on your bed or at the kitchen table on a laptop. It's not the same experience. But it's not just the logistics. It is, as I said, it's that they only know what they know about how their business works by having done it and lived it in their 20s and the 30s. So to try and deprive Alistair's generation and the next generation of that experience, I think is profoundly selfish. But I also don't think it will work, because I think that Alistair's generation, the ambitious part of it, will want to get back into town and will want to get meeting and drinking and talking and plotting again. And I think as long as something catastrophic doesn't happen with a second wave of the virus or subsequent waves, I think it'll be quite eccentric in a year or two's time to say, I'm one of those people that doesn't really venture in to meet people. I just sit at home typing and doing Zoom calls. I think people who choose to do that will quite often find themselves left behind. Do you agree, Alistair?
I really do agree with that. I mean, I think there's an accommodation. I think I've actually got the experience of having worked at Reaction in a surprising variety of different ways before the pandemic, you know, mm-hmm. both working from my kitchen table, then like the London Library, an office shared with a think tank, a couple of different think tanks, and then our own office. And I do agree that the most productive time in terms of Reaction I felt was when we had an office.
Yeah.
In terms of the friction of ideas, all that stuff. Personally, I quite like some degree of flexibility. So being able to, if you have a big piece to write, then why not write it in the best surroundings that you enjoy, whether that's a library or at home. But yeah, there is a fundamental disconnect between people who seem to herald the new normal as if we've suddenly struck gold with this cocktail of social distancing, you know, working from home, etc., not flying, all that. And actually, you're right. But there's a funny distance going on in terms of everyone I know is back to normal socially. The idea that you don't hug your friends when you see them or don't meet up for safety reasons, to me, is completely balmy. And I think to everyone I know is balmy. But in terms of work, we're very much trying to accustom ourselves to a new orthodoxy.
I think it is extraordinary that your generation, Alistair, and maybe you are all furious, but it doesn't seem to be manifesting itself other than in sort of people gathering to parties, with illegal raves and all the sort of stuff that Priti Patel wants to crack down on. I'm surprised you're not angrier as a generation, because it's incredible when you look at the numbers, the excess deaths below 45. I'm not in denial about the disease. It is a serious disease, but we know it's not the plague, and we know that it doesn't really kill anyone below the age of 40. But it seems as though we're heading back into a draconian phase once the autumn begins and the winter begins, in which people are going to be locked down universally. And we know that it doesn't, as I say, kill people below the age of 45. Mm. Will people become angrier about it, do you think, Maggie? Or is it just something that the restrictions have to be imposed across the generations? There's no way of sort of dividing for age. I just think as oldies, and I include myself, if we have to, if we have to make greater sacrifices, having, you know, already been young, but if we do have to make greater sacrifices during an outbreak and in terms of distancing, I'm perfectly prepared to do that. But the idea of locking up sort of younger Britain and in perpetuity and disrupting schooling and education and their start in work year after year to suit but of over 50s Britain strikes me as deranged.
Yeah, no. And Ian, I totally agree. And actually, I've been so impressed by all the youngsters I know, sort of from teens. And I think it must be very hard for sort of late teens people up until early 30s, but they're all sort of different. So people in their early 30s, perhaps who've been married with one child, they've, I think, perhaps enjoyed lockdown a lot more. But people in their 20s, like you, Alistair, and my younger son, young lawyer, sitting there all day, all night, just staring at four walls, you know, dealing with due diligence. It must be ghastly without having, you know, the repartee and comradeship of being in an office. But what has struck me is everybody's generosity and kindness. So most of my friends my age, they say their sons actually have been really strict with them. They won't hug them. They've kept away, you know, during that sort of, you know, shielding period, and actually have been cross with the parents for going out. So I think, yeah, we have a big responsibility to step back. And if we do go into a semi-strict lockdown, you know, again, we know what where to go, don't we? Care homes, anybody over risk. From 50s onwards, we should keep to ourselves and let the youngsters get on with it. And by the way, can I just mention, going back to offices, I do agree with you both there, but I do think what's happened is there's a mental shift. People have understood that you can work flexibly. I don't think it will go that way, by the way, but, you know, it will change.
I didn't want someone who spends, you know, even before the crisis, quite a bit of time working from home. Yeah. I didn't want to suggest that it's in all circumstances, a waste of time. It's obviously not the case. I do think it will mean that long term, it will remove some of that stigma. We've all seen someone do it, you know, working from home in inverted commas, as though there's something wrong with that, as though it involves skiving. It doesn't. The other thing which, and I wanted to ask you a bit, Alistair, we'll come on next to the pandemic itself, which we haven't talked about, and where you think we are, is that it will remove any notion, this sort of daft British, or maybe it's Anglo-Saxon, maybe it's Western more broadly, idea of if you have symptoms of something that's flu-like or cold-like, that you should battle on with it. That there's something macho about struggling to your desk and working from there rather than self-isolating and being conscious that you can then spread it. It might not be COVID-19. It might just be something as simple as a cold. And I think it will become normal years, decades hence to just say, right, the responsible thing to do is to stay at home. Work if you can, if not, take to your bed and recover, and don't spread whatever is in the community. But you've, Alistair, you've had a very good take throughout the crisis. I think it's fair to say I haven't agreed with you at every stage of it. I was more on the draconian side in March, maybe just as a product of I thought the government knew what they were doing in February, and it turns out that they didn't. But, and you're, it's not fair to describe you as a lockdown skeptic, but where do you think we are on the disease now and the progress of this thing, and we're going to and our attempts to learn to live with it?
Well, I was very supportive of the quarantine, actually, with a degree of, you know, if it sounds mad, i.e. telling a whole nation to stay at home in the context of the history of quarantine, in which that is, I think, with two very small examples, one in Yugoslavia, I think, a national lockdown has never happened to fight disease. And if in the context of the history of disease is a completely radical thing, and it's been taken in the kind of spirit in which it was in Europe, then I think some degree of skepticism was healthy. But I thought that it would be for 3 weeks to bring down cases, which was what the rationale was. And clearly wasn't that. It's become a kind of, I don't know how to describe it now. It's a kind of ideology and a philosophy. It pervades the working from home stuff. It's all about public safety, these ideas of care and safety, which taken to their absolute conclusions are actually very destructive. and I think can make people very blind to the costs and risks and rewards of living with infectious diseases, as you know, societies have learned to live with them for decades and centuries. But I'm not sure if that's a particularly good answer. I think
no, it's a very good answer. But where do you think we are in terms of the you know the progress of the disease? A lot of angst at the moment about second wave and rising cases, and some people saying, well, rising cases is fine. The thing to keep an eye on is hospitalizations and deaths. Difficult to get a handle on. People are particularly worried about France, and the government is really worried about France and Spain. Yeah. Is that something we should be concerned about?
I think there's a kind of there's a brutal reality to this disease. It basically, one, we've got this new way of looking at it, which is cases, which are done through a thing called a PCR test, which basically magnifies the amount of virus in your body several times until it can say you've got the virus, which is probably, if a scientist is listening, a really stupid way of explaining it. The case is at the moment, we don't know to what extent asymptomatic cases are infectious or even constitute disease. Around 75% of seasonal flu are asymptomatic. Now, I may have had flu for every flu season and not known of it, but I wouldn't have described myself as ill. But I might even have had antibodies to a particular strain. So it's really unclear to me what the function is of testing without heavy caveats about what we know. So this idea that we have this bold notion that cases are increasing and hospitalizations and deaths are, quote unquote, not far behind, are completely contingent on people's decision making and whether it comes into susceptible parts of the population. Because we know that the epidemic, what happened with the epidemic was in March and April, we saw a very, very high, big increase in deaths from coronavirus. Now, why did that happen? And it happened over and over again in lots of countries where it swept through. It's because it started hitting people who were 70, 60, 70 above. And that's where the vast majority of deaths come from. When we talk about waves, a true second wave would have a big, big impact in those susceptible populations. Now, what we're seeing now is a true second wave is, I think, a completely something that is difficult to say. I think it's interesting, it's all context dependent. France, they really didn't have that big a coronavirus outbreak outside of the Île-de-France and Paris because they locked down pretty early, I think, in the course of the epidemic. And France is heavily regionalized. So whereas England is a much denser country. Spain, again, very heavily regionalized. So what you may be seeing is just the coronavirus doing more of its work in other parts of the country, kind of topping itself up. Because it's based on, and I'm going on a bit, but it's a cluster-driven disease. It depends on kind of super, almost what you call super spreading events, but not even super spreading. It's like someone in a restaurant and it going 1 to 10 to 15. So that's how it spreads. I think in France and in Spain, the dynamics of the lockdown are affecting the epidemic now because they had, and people always said in this country, they had a proper lockdown in Spain and France. It was really aggressive. Ours was a sort of made up lockdown, but no one really complies, and et cetera, et cetera. It was all not as great. But I mean, fundamentally, what you do if you have a super aggressive lockdown is people's behavior doesn't actually change. In France, you hear anecdotes upon anecdotes, people are not obeying any social distancing.
Yeah,
they have just thought, let's get back to normal right away. And even in Sweden, they're not actually doing that. Germany has been the best model in Europe for pandemic response, which at all times has been a gradated response with tiny lockdown happening on a regional basis.
So what So what, Alistair, what, and I'll bring Maggie in as well. So, but what do we do about this? Because it seems to me that one of the strangest things that's happening, or the most sinister aspects of this, is the way in which it is maybe longer term altering people's conception of risk. And, you know, we now know that this is, I think there are 800 and something people in hospital with coronavirus. I stress again, it's a really serious disease. I'm not being cavalier about it, but how many people die in Britain every year? We know what's coming down the line. The recent Lancet report on cancer, which showed three different potential outcomes. Hope it's on the moderate side in terms of the delay there's been in diagnosis and treatment. So we know that that's coming. We know that GPs have not got back to normal and will not get back to normal, maybe even until next year. Goodness knows. And it seems to be distorting people's sense of what it is to be alive. I mean, every single day, all of us make hundreds, if not thousands, of small judgments, which are, unconsciously or not, risk assessments about about how we spend our time, about where we cross the road, about what the health risks are, weighing up whether it's a good idea to get some vitamin D or to risk exposure to sunlight and risk skin cancer. A million different decisions like that all the time. It is essentially the business of being human. But as a result of this crisis, there are now seem to be millions of people in the opinion polling suggests that the government messaging has worked, who are now terrified of this and seem to think that danger eclipses all other dangers, cancers, strokes, heart, all manner of other diseases. And this, am I wrong here, Maggie? This can't be healthy.
No, you're not wrong at all. And I certainly don't have the answer as to why we have all, well, most people have become utterly scared by this. I mean, the government's campaign was perhaps one of them, you know, save the NHS, save the NHS, save lives. One of the most successful campaign slogans of all time, scared the wits out of everybody. And I think people do appreciate it. You know the risk if you're going to drive on a motorway at 90 miles an hour. Vitamin D. So what is it about this? My own feeling is that it's because it's so unknowable. It's so invisible. We still don't know whether it's when you touch, you know, the tomatoes that you've just bought or the newspaper. I mean, think back 2 months ago, we were all sanitizing everything that came into the home. I mean, when I look back now, I sort of think, were we completely bonkers doing this? And now we're not. So we have moved on, I guess, in some respects. But it's this invisible thing. We don't know enough about it. We know it can kill. But also, as Alistair says, well, the average age of death in Britain, I think, is 81.
And it was the same, and it's not a, and I think this is true, not a single person between the age of 20 to 30 has died from coronavirus in the whole of Italy, which is an extraordinary stat. I mean, the way I think about it is, one, this is a simple anecdote. You know, my grandfather was a GP for many years. He still volunteers at the local hospital. He's in contact with people there. He's saying, particularly, and this is a public health bit of advice from the Reaction podcast, particularly, he says, middle-aged women need to get out. They are terrified. And I don't know whether that's just Scotland with Auntie, you know, Nicola doing her Mother of the Nation act every few nights on telly, being angry with footballers for going to the pub and, you know, generally behaving incredibly aggressively about it. I mean, you know, the big public health risk for these people is being inactive for long periods of time. It's a really dangerous thing to do. But what has happened, I think, is I don't know who described anxiety like this, but I always find it a very vivid and excellent example. Anxiety is like having a fear of heights all the time. But it's not really the fear of the abyss and falling down it. It's the fear that that bit between you and the abyss will just suddenly sort of decrease in size. And it's that fluctuating little strip of patch of solid ground between you and the abyss. And on a good day, it might be, you might be quite a long way from it. And on a bad, you're very, very close. But that's the character of the fear. And what you're, how you're beginning to live is with that as if. But it's not an ideal as if, like you live as if you could fall in love tomorrow, or you live as if you could,
climb a mountain. Could,
yeah, or have a really joyful experience, or have an encounter with nature, or have an encounter with the sublime or God. And to be happy, I think you always have to live with that sensation of, you have to live as if those things are really possible. And I think what's happened to our society is the reverse. Everything is as if we are just by the abyss, and we are just on this strip of land, and sometimes it recedes, and sometimes gets smaller. And I think this has collided particularly with young people. My generation, it's like the reversal of post-war youth. We are the most risk-averse generation in decades. We drink less, we take fewer drugs, smoke less even. And I think that's reflected in some of the polling about getting back to the office, in that older people seem to be more blasé. I've had so many conversations with friends who sort of early on in the epidemic were berating, as you say, parents for ignoring rules. I think I don't know how else to express it than we are gripped with a pathology, and it's basically anxiety. And we're already really anxious. I just don't know how that unwinds, and I don't know how you move on from that. But
yeah, sure. I mean, one upbeat interpretation is that this thing, if it either fades away, as sometimes happens, or the much talked about second wave doesn't happen with the same intensity that people fear that it will, and then people start to understand treatment is huge advances have been made and continue to be made. Mm-hmm. Plus there's the prospect of vaccines that you then get, in the words of a regular listener to the Reaction podcast and reader of Reaction, you then get our own version of the Roaring Twenties. That there's just such a kick from the joy of people realizing that it wasn't the end of, it was bad, but it wasn't the end of the world, and rediscovering all of those things, just like listening to live music. I was immersed in the rattle at the Proms the other night. Just the thrill of seeing real people, although it was on the television, together, gathered, creating something marvelous and enjoying it. So maybe you just get that feeling multiplied 10 million times. I mean, I had a similar experience with a bunch of people for drinks a couple of weeks ago, social distancing observed and all that sort of thing. But just the joy of, after initially finding conversation and socializing a bit strange, it then, 2 or 3 hours in, a drink kicked in. People were just in love with the idea of socializing and jokes and conversation and argument, and hopefully that's what next year will be about. Actually, let's hope it's not. If it's the Roaring Twenties, that ends really badly, doesn't it?
Yeah,
she said it's followed by the 1930s. Anyway, so that's a bad parallel. But shall we talk a little bit about? We were going to talk about Whitehall and the appointment of Simon Case to be the new cabinet secretary. Do we want to talk firstly? Let's quickly talk about Trump and Biden. We're going to be doing a lot more on all of that this autumn. But it kind of looks now the betting odds have gone in Trump's favor. I'm trying to work out whether that is the result of anything meaningful in opinion poll terms, but it certainly, it looks and it feels to me, and let's be honest, everyone's guessing here, it feels to me now, Maggie, as though Biden is in some form of trouble. And actually, I think I would be surprised if Biden wins now. It feels to me, because of what's happened with the riots, as though it's Trump's election.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. It's certainly going to be tight. Is it 2.4% of the vote is what will swing it, as they say? I think in a weird way, the economy does seem to be bouncing back in the US. The employment numbers have certainly recovered. And he is looking to do quite a few interesting measures, cutting taxes and so forth. So if Clinton was right that it's the economy, then that's on his side. Now, whether the riots, I can't work out from here, and I don't know America well enough, if they work more in his favour or in Biden's favour. There's clearly a big issue there. Now, is it Trump and law and order and cracking down that will persuade people to back him, or is it the Biden view, which we have to sort of solve this crisis, that will bring people?
I think it's the culture war stuff. That's a phrase that is maybe overused, but in this case, I think it really matters. If you the stuff to track is the video, and there's a lot of it about, and some of it's very powerful. The video from some of the worst protests turned to rioting. Oh. So, for example, the viral quote, the viral clip from the restaurant last week, where the protesters were attempting to force people to raise their fist in solidarity and essentially harassing those who refused to comply, even if they agreed with the broad aims of Black Lives Matter. That went viral. That stuff is not. There is an argument to say, well, it's not getting played on CNN, but most of the voters who are going to decide this, and the last US election came down to around 80,000 voters, 80,000 voters in three crucial states, and it could be similar this time. That stuff is circulating on social media and on Facebook. I mean, the one that was going viral this morning was the Death to America chants, which is what marchers were shouting last night. Now, that doesn't mean that every person who's protesting thinks that or is saying it, and it may be a couple of hundred people within a larger demonstration. But you then clip that and share it several million times, and the Republicans will be amplifying that stuff and sending out video, which essentially says, this is what's behind Joe Biden. Now, I thought Biden's speech last night was actually very good. One terrible slip in it, one mistake, which has been shared by Trump and Trump supporters. But I thought it was actually a really quite solid speech. But which illustrates to me the principal problem with Biden, which is similar to Clinton, is that somehow up against Trump, they've landed themselves once again with a candidate who's a problem, who has core weaknesses that you need to obscure from the electorate. It's almost as though he's fragile, rather than a candidate like Obama in 2008, where if you're a Democrat, you want to sit, or even an independent, you want to see more of him. And the more he speaks, the more energizing he is as a candidate. I'm an Obama skeptic. Instead, you've got a bit like Clinton in 2016, a candidate who has to be protected and who can slip, and there's just something not confident about the candidate. And Trump is a phenomenal campaigner. What's your perspective, Alistair?
Just to come back to the protests. Movement, if it can be described as a protest movement. But think back to last time America was gripped by this, I think the quality of this kind of unrest and the kind of the culture war-y aspects and you could almost call it the home front of the Vietnamese of the Vietnam War, was that war on campus and in America's cities in the 60s. And of course, and it culminated in 68, which let's be honest, was far, far more violent than this year has been so far. And I hope I'm, you know, I hope that's correct, that I just don't think it will be as anywhere near as devastating as 68. But what killed the protest movement in the eyes of the public, or whatever you call it, the silent majority, what killed it, I think, in the end, was one, its tactics were too diffuse, but two, it's because they kept on doing stupid stuff. Jane Fonda going to then Hanoi, or Ho Chi Minh City, and saying stuff like, these American soldiers are war criminals, I think was the kind of money quote that was incredibly divisive at the time. It was people protesting American soldiers returning home and calling them baby killers. Soldiers who were often hugely skeptical about the costs of what they were doing, didn't understand what they were doing, had been drafted, were often really poor, because the rich middle-class people, particularly middle-class students, could always miss the draft if they wanted by pulling some stunt. And that kind of push and pull, which I think really played against the protest movement then, but now you've got social media, which can multiply the effects of this stuff to 100,000%. The debate at the moment is being defined by these one-off encounters with protesters who, as far as I can see, are completely chicken-headed and do not understand what they're doing, what they actually feel, are just completely mired in this weird self-recrimination.
But aren't there are different strands of the protests and protesters, and the hardest core part of the protests is people who hate Joe Biden as much as they hate Donald Trump. So they hate the center. They're even probably they might, on a, you know, if they were feeling generous, accept Sanders, but actually that they are revolutionary Marxists who want to blow the thing up. So that their aim is they don't actually care about the result of the result of the election beyond, will it create further chaos, which creates opportunity for this magical revolutionary moment, which they somehow envisage, plus the chance to smash things up, which is there's a portion of human beings, particularly people disposed like that with that political disposition, who just like smashing things up, and this is a great opportunity. But the way that then is the way that then turns into social media clips to be utilized by the Republicans, it's potentially catastrophic for Biden, which is why I said I'm assuming, don't make a prediction, but it feels like a Trump win at the moment.
For anyone who you're it's that quality, isn't it? But I think the kind of elephant in the room there, and sorry, Maggie, I cut you off, but it's this. For anyone who care, I think we all care, or anyone who is sensible about politics cares about the state of, the reality is all this stuff stems from the total breakdown of what used to be thought of as an organized left. And not saying, organized left in the sense of revolutionary movements. I mean, the kind of civic legacy of left-wing organizations, whether it's America and Europe, which try and intercede between the employee and the employer, things like craft trade unions, all that stuff, which now doesn't seem to really resonate, has just dissipated into this really weird mishmash of groups which have no which are very decentralized, actually, don't have good leaders, don't have good thinkers, attracts narcissists, and are so diffuse that they can be, that they're full of fools, really. I mean, even something like Occupy Wall Street, you know, was useless because, and this is just after the moment that financial capitalism has almost broken the Western politics. And you had this movement which was didn't want to have any leaders. They tried to do everything by group votes. I mean, come on. What kind of organization does that? I mean, so all of this stems in a really sad way from the crisis that you're talking about with Biden and with Sanders. But no one is able to forcibly present a kind of, you know, maybe someone like Starmer, who just is sort of like a left winger in the sense that he believes in human rights with a strong sort of legal basis. You know, even that I don't think is actually close to coming towards what used to be called a left-wing movement that actually spoke to people and spoke to ideas like patriotism or whatever. I'm sounding very like Blue Labour, but
the whole sort of cooperative, neutral, all those, as you say, civic societies, it's sort of the Methodist Church, the Friends, Quakers, you know, all that is what you're referring to, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's
nothing
yet.
Just gone.
Absolutely. So we were going to talk a bit about Whitehall and Simon Case and all that sort of stuff. Do we still want to mention that? It's the big Westminster story as everyone returns or doesn't return, returns virtually, but Westminster's back as of this week, and Simon Case is the new cabinet secretary. What does it mean, Maggie?
I think I'm going to turn the question around and ask you, actually, because you say, and you were telling us earlier on, that you're rather impressed by this man and that the people who want to hit Boris are obviously using the Case appointment as a, oh God, another Brexiteer stooge and so forth. And yet you were telling this man is not a stooge by any account, rather a brilliant scholar, taught by Peter Hennessy, the great constitutionalist. So tell us a bit about him and why he's good or should be a good appointment.
Yeah, I find it a bit dispiriting, or maybe it just speaks to how divided our politics has become, and everything is now weaponized in what's even post-Brexit, Brexit v. Remain arguments, in which the fact that he's been appointed by Boris therefore means that, and yes, I'm meaning Twitter, but Twitter's a small thing, but it's still in political terms quite a lot of people creating quite a lot of noise who want to see something somehow questionable in his appointment. He strikes me, everything I've read his PhD thesis, which is really, really interesting, on the Joint Intelligence Committee in Germany. He's a fascinating guy, one of the most talented officials of his generation. He's only 41, which his critics also seem to see as a problem, but that's not really that young. And he's worked for a lot of senior politicians. I haven't heard anything that makes me think other than that he's a very talented guy and a really good appointment. I will be fascinated to see how he fits in with the Cummings alleged revolution of government and the state that's about to happen. We're told, and Cummings this week has moved to this thing at 70 Whitehall, which is a NASA style horseshoe shape or circle or whatever, and circle of trust or circle of distrust, in which data in real time will be beamed onto the walls and it'll be this control pod. I just find it such unutterable bollocks. I've seen it in newspapers attempted, newsrooms, you know, if you beam sort of numbers onto the wall and people will work harder and be more creative, they won't. Gordon Brown tried something like it in number 10, or was it, he'd moved it to number 9, an operation where they could all watch the television and be driven by Sky News and News 24. It didn't work then. It's never worked in a newsroom. And I don't think that you can run something as complex as the British state in that way. But maybe I'm being unduly cynical, but I'm fascinated to see how Case, who's seen as a can-do person by Team Cummings, but he's also an establishment figure who's come the establishment route and worked for Prince William. How will he balance all of that? How will he do enough of the revolutionary stuff that Cummings wants, but also be a classic cabinet secretary as well? My bet would be, and knowing the type and the type that becomes cabinet secretary or a permanent secretary, is that he'll play both ends off against the middle, because he'll have to. And ultimately, if he has to make a call, it'll be based on what the prime minister wants rather than what other advisors want. But I don't know. Alistair, you have an interesting historical perspective on it.
I totally agree about, by the way, the idea of running government in real time. I mean, that is just ludicrous. I mean, the major problem for government, as I see it at the moment, is that minuting is not done properly and there isn't enough institutional memory and things just disappear. And this is not good for bureaucracies, because bureaucracies tend to be quite good at disappearing things that are important. It's actually a real crisis. And it's, to come back to the history, it is in reverse, precisely the same crisis that the modern civil service, as we understand it, was brought into life to combat. You know, 100 years ago during the First World War, there was this real perception that the war was being fought, there were loads of really bad decisions being taking place, and it culminated with the Somme disaster. And that one of the reasons that lots of bad decisions were being made was that people would go into cabinet and then would leave with no clear idea of what the settled will of the debates had been or the meeting, because there was no proper systematic minuting. Now, what then happened was Lloyd George streamlines the war cabinet and brought in a guy who'd worked in defence, naval defence, called Maurice Hankey, who is incidentally is my great-great-grandfather and is a kind of legend of the family, in that he was then went on to serve as the longest serving cabinet secretary. And I think he was the second youngest cabinet secretary ever, and Simon Case is the youngest. So age is no barrier. And if he goes on to serve as long as Maurice Hankey did, well, he'll be, you know, he'll finish his career in that post, really. But what happened then was you just had a much more systematic government. You know, the war effort was turned around, the institutions worked better. Hankey went on to do lots of really interesting stuff in terms of that era. In the interwar period was an era of big diplomatic conferences. And there's a level of pathos here in that we all know the names, like the Locarno Treaty or Versailles, that era of international cooperation. And Hankey was asked to become the secretary of the nascent League of Nations. Didn't really create global order. In fact, it sort of created the conditions for things to unfold, to unravel very quickly in the 30s. But that kind of systematic view, which said that governance matters and that you need strong, robust processes, that's what the British state needs at the moment. And I'm not sure, with Cummings, this emphasis on comms and the kind of the real-time government in which you're reacting at speed, is kind of the opposite of what you need, which is just old-fashioned, good institutional processes with lots of memory, with big, good reference points and people knowing stuff. It's not complicated, and you can kind of game it with technology or try and create a sophisticated new thing. But as you said, that Gordon Brown was photographed in exactly the same setup 10 years ago.
Yeah,
with screens and everyone smiling away, but it was a completely waste of time. But anyway.
So, final thought to you, Maggie.
I think you're both too cynical or sceptical, or whichever is the appropriate word, I mean, the news screens and all the NASA stuff is perhaps, you know, is gimmicky. But don't you sometimes have to say, well, look, let's look at things a little bit differently. Can we do it better? How can we improve it? So to get everybody, make them sit up, you have to perhaps shock them. Can't that be a good thing? Why should government be sort of stuck in jelly forever?
Definitely, absolutely. But then you have to kind of, you know, you have to show how you can do it better as well. And I think it's a common criticism of Cummings, but it's actually unfortunate. We do have to talk about him because he is actually very important in the government, and a lot of stuff flows through him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of it seems to come back to his personality to an extent, which is hard to get around. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like a fast bowler who starts swearing at an opposition player, but then starts getting smacked around and then can't come back with a better answer, or can't bother bounce, so it's going to take his head off.
But wonders will never cease. Don was pictured this morning, I think, going into number 10 wearing a suit, which is a few times he's been seen in a suit. So obviously something was happening at the moment that he actually had to...
Counter-revolution.
Yeah, precisely. So wonders will never cease. We'll see. But I think we'll bring things to an end there. I'm just going to say thank you for listening. And if you're not a Reaction subscriber, please become a subscriber. Go to the website. Really straightforward. £60 for the year, or £6 paying by the month. We've expanded the journalism that we do in the last few months throughout the crisis. Loads more to come this autumn and beyond. And if you want to read the brilliant work that the team does and all the writing, as I say, become a subscriber. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.